Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, new political maps for California elections. How the work of a Citizens Redistricting Commission could affect politicians' job security. And in Napa, a summer camp helps students who are blind appreciate science.
Nobody can see atoms. You guys are not looking at a nitrogen-nitrogen triple bond. Honestly, most reactions are clear. So there's no reason you can't think about chemistry.
Also, a new exhibit celebrating the Anything Goes era in Yosemite before rules tightened up on behavior in the park. And we'll meet an L.A. punk rocker who moonlights with a marimba.
It's a weird instrument because it's everywhere. Once you learn what it is, you'll hear it on car commercials. You'll hear it in movies. I mean, it's the most ubiquitous instrument.
It's the California Report. Well, as we settle into summer, the only maps most of us Californians are thinking about are the kind that help us drive to our favorite vacation getaways. But in Sacramento Friday, politicians were eager to see a different kind of map, the work of a Citizens Redistricting Commission that's redrawing their legislative boundaries. The California Report's Sacramento Bureau Chief, John Myers, is poring over the new maps. And first of all, John, what jumps out at you?
You know, Scott, I think the biggest thing that stands out in these districts is how even when you take out politics, which is really what the voters wanted taken out, they approved this independent commission to draw the maps. When you take out the politics, redistricting really still produces some very strange-looking legislative and congressional districts. These are about as apolitical as political maps can get. But the public has been led to believe that the only reason that there are now sprawling districts is gerrymandering, political advantage. But, you know, when you take out the politics and you still have to use population issues and minority rights, voting issues, and those things have to be honored, you get some odd-looking districts. Commissioner Gabino Aguirre, one of the 14 members, this is what he said he would tell people who want just little square districts.
I mean, that's the easy answer to a very complex problem. To the maximum extent possible, we've drawn districts that, in our view, are possibly the most compact and contiguous at this time.
So, John Myers, it may be a little too soon to say, but does it look like there are some obvious winners and losers here?
I think it does. If you look at some of the early analyses, some big changes, I think, for members of Congress. I think for starters, it looks as though there could be 3, 4, even 5 fewer Republicans in Congress from California. Keep in mind that GOP registration in the state has been going down. But I think more fascinating is how many members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, look like they're now going to be living in a district with another incumbent. Now, one early analysis I saw shows as many as 10 dual incumbent districts, from Pete Stark and Jerry McNerney in the San Francisco Bay Area, to Dana Rohrabacher and John Campbell in the same district in Orange County, to get this one, Dennis Cardoza, Jeff Denham, and Jim Costa, all three in the same district in Congress in the Central Valley. Those will bring about real changes in the actual politicians. I think whether it brings more moderation or less ideologues, that's really the question the voters will have to get answers on later.
And I guess these merging of the districts, that's a result of the census? Does it kind of reflect population shifts in California? Is that what we're seeing?
I think it's both population and it is, again, this commission did not use political party registration. That's a real difference from when legislators drew maps. And so as a result, they weren't looking to see what the competitive political advantage or disadvantage was. And in some cases, you've got people now and together in areas that maybe should have been together before the politicians were drawing them.
And John, you know, the thinking, one of the rationales for taking this out of the hands of the legislature is that they would carve out the safe districts for themselves. And that would lead to legislators who were either extremely liberal or extremely conservative with, you know, really very little interest in compromising. How likely do you think that is to change because of these new maps?
Well, you know, it's the big question everybody wants to know, Scott, especially here in Sacramento, because when we look at the maps for the legislature, all the Assembly and Senate districts that are drawn, you know, you've got some potential for changes there, too. You've got people lumped in districts together. You've got districts that will change. But nobody really knows. And I think one thing that will be interesting to watch is that there is no budget deal yet. They are going to debate it all the way here through this weekend. And I think next week, as we get here in Sacramento talking about the budget and some early looks have really been done at these maps and at these districts, then we'll see, you know. Is there any kind of change about who my new constituents are and how do I have to vote?
John, if there is going to be criticism of the maps that this commission has drawn, who do you think it's going to come from and what might they be criticizing?
I think it'll come from all corners of the political world, but I think the only one, Scott, that matters really is the rights of minority voters. There are federal rights about the rights of minority voters, especially for Latino voters in California. I think you're going to get some questions about that, but I think it's important also to remember there will be more public hearings on these maps. There will be a whole second set of drafts in July, and the final maps don't come out until August, so there's a lot of drawing, a lot that can still change.
And then finally, John, we've got a budget stalemate up in Sacramento. You alluded to this a moment ago. Any chance that this is likely to change these maps or likely to change the calculation for these politicians up there as to whether or not to be for the governor's budget?
Well, you know, certainly some of it's going to depend on when they really get the political party registration data about their new districts, and they've all got consultants working on that through the weekend. The legislature also has the impact of term limits that will change things. But I think there is going to be a very interesting set of discussions. I can almost hear the phones ringing of politicians calling their political consultants saying, what do I do? What's this going to mean to me? You know, that'll be very interesting to watch.
That's Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. You can read more about this on his blog, Capital Notes. You'll find it at our website, californiareport.org. John, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Summer camp is a time for kids to have fun with all kinds of things, from whitewater rafting to horseback riding, swimming, music, even computers. But in the hills outside Napa recently, a group of high school students gathered for a different kind of experience, a summer science camp. There were test tubes, volatile chemicals, and pipettes, of course. But as Amy Standen reports, these weren't your typical campers.
Hobie Wedler has always loved chemistry, but he says in high school, one of his teachers gave him some advice that was hard to dismiss. She told him he'd be better off studying something else, something more practical.
She basically said you can never do chemistry as a career because you can't do labs.
Wedler has been blind since birth, which can be an obstacle when you're trying to pour carbolic acid into a test tube or even just tell if a chemical reaction has taken place.
You have to look at color changes. You have to look at when a reaction is bubbling. And you have to be observant, and apparently vision was the only way to observe things.
What Wedler realized is that with a little help, he could do chemistry. In fact, he's starting a PhD program in theoretical organic chemistry at UC Davis this fall. But before that starts up, he had an idea. A chemistry camp for blind kids, sponsored by the Lighthouse for the Blind, a San Francisco nonprofit, and the National Federation of the Blind.
Each group member take a few whiffs and notice the smell changing. And make any observations about the smell change.
The idea is to show that chemistry isn't just a visual science, that many lab experiments can be done through touch or smell. Jimmy Kong, a sophomore from Santa Rosa, positions a fan behind a test tube so the fumes drift toward him.
Smells like weak garlic.
Yeah.
Ultimately, says Wedler, chemistry is like anything else. It's something you do with your brain.
You know, nobody can see atoms. You guys are not looking at a nitrogen-nitrogen triple bond. Honestly, most reactions are clear, so there's no reason you can't think about chemistry.
There probably wouldn't be a need for summer camps like this if not for a law passed in 1975 called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The intentions were good. Disabled kids should be able to go to the same public schools as other kids. But in reality, it's meant that a lot of blind kids don't get the specialized help they need, especially in science class, says Mary Willis, a teacher, blind since high school, who came to volunteer at the camp.
This is the first time some of these people have ever touched a test tube or a pipette or any of that.
In classrooms with sighted kids, blind students often end up being the note takers or just sitting the whole thing out.
Everybody else gets to participate and you have to just sit. That erodes confidence, that erodes self-esteem. And eventually, you just give up.
This issue of passivity, of giving up, is a very real threat for blind people, a group where unemployment hovers near 70%. And that fact really haunts some of these students, like 17-year-old Mary Church, who lives in Hollister. This camp was one of the few times in her life she'd ever spent in a group composed almost entirely of blind people.
I'm really surprised that they haven't called me crybaby yet, because I have broken down about school this weekend so many times.
Living in a small town, the only blind kid in her class, Mary says school is a constant struggle. Textbooks aren't available in Braille when she needs them. Teachers routinely give her homework assignments that, as a blind person, she can't do. And when people try to help her, sometimes their efforts end up making her feel even more isolated, like her advanced biology teacher.
I've tried to work with my teacher with this all year, is that he wants to give extra credit to the students who work with me.
What?
That was Mary Willows, the teacher we heard from earlier.
Yeah, it makes me feel pretty degraded because it feels like people are using me to get a better grade in class, and I'm just another student who's trying to learn too.
Chemistry camp isn't just about chemistry. It's about pushing through, and as a blind person in a sighted world, learning to pick your battles. Later that afternoon, I find Mary sitting next to Jimmy Kong, the 16-year-old from Santa Rosa. He's strumming a guitar in the dining hall. Jimmy says he knows Mary can be pretty sensitive.
But I'm just not trying to sound like a jerk, you know. But it's just, you just gotta deal with it. I don't really know what to say. It's just hard. I don't know.
I get pretty put off by some things people say because I'm really sensitive.
But she says she's learning.
You can't take all of everything people say to heart because sometimes people don't really mean what they say. It's just, unfortunately, it's just the way the world works.
After lunch, back in the classroom, the students are going through a lesson about how acids and bases interact.
So we added 5 squirts of the sodium hydroxide, and then we have 1 molar HCl. So how many squirts do you think it's going to take her before we're going to smell anything?
Mary's been pretty quiet until now, but she figured this one out in her head, and she thinks she knows the answer.
Probably 10. I don't know.
Probably close to maybe 10, right?
Yeah.
5 squirts later, the unmistakable smell of onion.
Oh, I smell it now.
Mary was right.
Yeah, definitely. 10 is the magic number.
As for what the future holds, Hobie Wedler, the organizer, plans to be a college chemistry professor. Mary Church is still trying to figure it out. For now, she's happy learning about chemistry, hanging out with her new friends, doing the kinds of things teenagers do. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
Well, anyone heading to Yosemite this summer can expect long lines of cars and plenty of camping restrictions. It wasn't always that way. In the early 20th century, cars were actually encouraged. Campers sprawled out in the meadows, and get this, giant streaks of fire fell from the granite cliffs. Alice Daniel has this story about a new Yosemite Valley Museum exhibit showcasing that era.
There's a place that's got me going, where the breeze is blowing, in the Yosemite. I've got to hurry to the place. It's Camp Curry. Surely it's the place for me.
Tom Bopp regularly strikes the piano keys for folks at the Wawona Hotel. But today, he's outside the Yosemite Valley Museum celebrating early park life with some old tunes. Inside, the one-room exhibit includes Ansel Adams and Edward Weston photographs, vintage hotel and camp brochures, a 1920s wooden dog sled, an Indian brand motorcycle, and even a 9-pound trout caught in the Merced River. And there's also the original sheet music for the 1915 song Bop is Singing, Toot Your Horn for Camp Curry.
And its sole purpose was to encourage people to drive their cars into Yosemite. It came right out in the ragtime era. So toot your horn for Curry and keep on tooting too. Fill up your lungs and let a mighty toot roar from you.
It was an anything-goes era for Yosemite. Dog sledding in the valley, winter ice carnivals, and yes, even the world-renowned firefalls from Glacier Point that were a mainstay of the park until the late 60s.
A mound of red fir bark is piled at the edge of the cliff and set afire.
A promotional film describes the flames turning to bright embers as thousands of onlookers below sound the call to let the fire fall.
Then the waiting fire tenders push the coals over the brink, silently the glowing cascade fans out into a fiery cataract.
Julia Parker is a Native American who lived in Yosemite's Indian village beginning in the late 40s. She says the exhibit's historic sign for Camp Curry reminds her of the fire fall.
Curry Village up there, they would sing in order to have Indian way, they would sing the Indian love call when they pushed the fire fall over. And so that always, I kind of get a big kick out of that. This is my friend here. Charlotte Ewing.
I know.
Yeah, Charlotte Ewing. She is, you can tell her what you're doing.
Barker's friend, Charlotte Ewing Wilson, grew up in Yosemite and says the valley was her playground. She came to the exhibit after visiting her grandparents' graves in the nearby Pioneer Cemetery.
My grandfather was here in the cavalry before it was a park. He was stationed at Wawona.
Wilson was born in 1927, the same year the Ahwahnee Hotel was built. She recalls playing croquet with Shirley Temple on the hotel's lawn. Jack Benny gave her an autograph, and she witnessed other celebrity icons riding around in fancy convertibles.
Icons didn't mean too much to me in those days. I remember seeing a blonde go by my grandpa's house, and somebody told me it was Jean Harlow, but I had no clue who Jean Harlow was.
She says Yosemite has changed a lot since she was a little girl, but it's still home. One reason the 84-year-old took the mountain roads from nearby Mariposa for a nostalgic glimpse of her past. The exhibit of early 20th century life in the park runs through October. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Yosemite.
Tell us what you think about stories you hear or would like to hear on the California Report. Send your email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. While you're there, you'll see everything we archive. And if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us on iTunes. There's a sport played by many Mexicans and Mexican-Americans throughout much of California, and yet it remains largely unknown for most who are outside that community. Some people call it Mexican rodeo, and it's really popular. But as Ruxandra Guidi from KPBS in San Diego reports, it's tough to find a place to play it in California.
At the end of the workday, a few men gather for weekly practice at a stable in San Isidro, just north of the California-Mexico border. Filemon Jara is riding atop his horse, Rojillo, lasso in hand. He's practicing the colas, or bull wrestling, one of the nine traditional moves that require the charro to wrestle a bull by the tail, as he rides beside him.
I grew up into this sport because my dad has carried it in his blood, and it's just more than a sport for him, it's a way of life.
Jara's grandfather and great-grandfather also play the traditional sport, which dates back to the haciendas of 16th century Mexico in what are now large chunks of the southwestern United States. But today, it's become increasingly difficult for these charros to find affordable land to practice and perform. And despite their popularity in the Mexican immigrant community, charros have failed to explain to many local governments in California what exactly it is that they do. 2 months ago, council members took on the issue in the city of Escondido, near San Diego. After 39 years of leasing city-owned property for only $1 a month, the charros faced eviction from the Escondido Arena, or Lienzo, where they hold their charreadas. Jesús Bañuelos is the president of the Escondido Charro Association.
Pues mire, la realidad, yo no lo entendí nada.
I don't know why we're being kicked out. We never had any problems, and I've always followed my contract and the city's laws.
Ed Gallo is a council member in Escondido. He says the reason for the eviction is simple. The city needs the land to store maintenance equipment.
It's the land that is there, belongs to the city, and we have an opportunity to create more revenue for the city so that we can provide more services.
This conflict between charros and the cities hosting them has surfaced throughout Southern California even as the sport grows in attendance. Julian Nava is a former U.S. ambassador to Mexico under President Jimmy Carter. He's among the fans who showed up to the Escondido hearing.
Escondido could become, in Southern California, a center for this type of equestrian activities because People coming from Mexico have taken charro sports all over the country. I mean, there are lienzos in Michigan. There's a lienzo in Maine, for heaven's sakes. So it's becoming a national sport.
There are more than 100 charro associations in the U.S., a fact mourned by animal rights groups who say the horses and cattle are subject to injury. In the mid-90s, Alameda County became the first jurisdiction to pass an ordinance banning what's known as horse tripping and steer tailing at charreadas. Charros say if the game is to succeed like its cousin, the American rodeo, they will have to gain the support of people outside the Mexican community. On a sunny Sunday, Filemon Jara, his two brothers, and their father travel 2 hours north to a big charreada just outside Los Angeles. They've come in full charro gear, tight pants and olive green shirts embroidered with their team's initials, SY for San Isidro. Theirs is an expensive hobby. Each one of those embroidered shirts costs around $150, and keeping a horse can mean up to $300 a month. Jara Sr. says the expense limits the tradition's widespread appeal, not just among fans, but among charros as well.
Poco a poco.
Little by little, the charros here in California are learning more about the sport. One would like to be at the same level of skill as charros in Mexico, but it's hard here. We have many more challenges. We all have busy jobs which fund our charreadas.
As this charreada comes to a close, the next teams prepare for the second competition of the day. Among them are the Escondido Charros, who have become something of a celebrated case in the Southern California scene. They've got nowhere to practice now, having lost the rights to their arena, but they say they're not willing to give up their sport. For the California Report, I'm Ruxandra Guidi in San Diego.
We've got photos of the Jara family and other charros in action. You can find them on our website, californiareport.org. The legendary L.A. punk band X hasn't put out a new record in years, but its members still get back together for a handful of live shows every year. In fact, the band is playing a few cities across California this month. Its founding members also stay busy with a bunch of other projects. That includes Don DJ Bonebreak. As KPCC's Stephen Cuevas reports, Bonebreak is one punk rocker who's just as comfortable playing jazz and classical music.
Most people have heard DJ Bonebreak like this, as the long-serving, hard-hitting timekeeper behind the band X. Fewer people have heard the other side of Bonebreak on the latest album by LA's Orchestra Superstring. Bonebreak goes from LA punk fury to California cool jazz.
Rhythmically, I can take more chances on the mallet instruments as opposed to playing drums, because the drummer has to hold down the beat. Say on the vibes, you can just take a breath and then play some weird rhythm, and as long as you know where you are.
Bonebreak is a veteran vibraphonist and marimba player. Like a lot of other punk rock musicians who joined a band, then figured out how to play, Bonebreak was a seasoned percussionist when he hooked up with what would become one of the seminal American rock bands of the 1980s.
Go back before X, and I was playing in a big band. I was playing in a Dixieland band. I was playing in three community orchestras. I want new experiences. You know, someone says, oh, if the orchestra's going to play the Shostakovich Eighth Symphony, it's like, wow, that sounds great. You know, it's exciting.
In the early 80s, Bonebreak was pretty much the only guy in LA's underground music scene who knew his way around a vibraphone and a marimba. It was the start of a successful side career as a percussionist for hire.
You know, I'm known as the rock and roll guy from the punk era who had a marimba, and, you know, I played it with Geza X and the Mommy Men. Geza said, hey, you own that marimba. Do you want to play in my band? And then the Flesh Eaters is another band. They said, oh, you play that weird instrument? That was my little tiny career as a marimba player. See you in the boat. I'll shoot me out of bed. I'll get. This marimba is, it's called a Deegan Imperial.
Inside a converted rehearsal studio behind his tidy San Fernando Valley home, DJ Bonebreak stands behind an enormous 8-foot-long wooden marimba that he bought off a music teacher 25 years ago.
It's a weird instrument because it's everywhere. Once you learn what it is, you'll hear it on car commercials, you'll hear it in movies. I mean, it's the most ubiquitous instrument, both the marimba and the vibes. You start to see patterns and it becomes easier. You just see all the notes that you can play. And the really fun thing about playing jazz is that you try to find those notes that don't fit in the pattern. In fact, that's one reason I started playing, because I couldn't understand how jazz players could play all the wrong notes and they sounded right. You know, I've been trying to understand the art of jazz. It's an adventure playing jazz because you don't know what you're going to do exactly. You study as much as you can, but you're just playing in the moment. And you're looking for that outside thing.
Bonebreak is a restless musician, unwilling to rest on the laurels of past glories and always looking for a new outlet. From the edgy Latin jazz of Orchestra Superstring to the modern experimentation of the Bonebreak Trio to the occasional stint with the Palisade Symphony. He's a sought-after session player, too. He's worked with everyone from John Lee Hooker to Ricky Lee Jones. Bonebreak may also be willing to record the drums for your band for a modest fee of $250 per track.
Why do I do that? I'm trying to make a living. I'm a sideman. Give me a gig. I'll play anything. I play weddings. Come to DJ Bonebreak Music and I'll record real drums for you. I want to play every day. I mean, I don't want to sit around, you know, and wait. And in most of these projects, you can't play every day because you don't make enough money. People have other gigs. So my attitude is I say yes to everything. I do as much as I can. Any of the bands I play with, I could play with every day.
That includes saying yes to occasional reunions with X. The band plays a handful of shows across California next week. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Jefferson Beavers, Julia Bernstein, and Nicholas Carpenter. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Victoria Malayon is our producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.